Bill Connors, senior sports editor of the Tulsa World, was known by three generations of Oklahoma sports fans for his incisive reporting and precise writing. He was 11 times Oklahoma Sports Writer of the Year, and in 1998 entered the Oklahoma Sports Hall of Fame. Connors joined the World staff full-time in 1953. By the mid-1960s, he had acquired a national reputation, contributing to many major sports publications and also Southern Living. He was 68 when he died June 2, 2000. Sports historian Wayne McCombs interviewed Bill July 27, 1998. They covered many topics, including Glenn Dobbs, Henry Iba, OU Texas games, Mickey Mantle, the Boston Red Sox's Ted Williams, and more. This is a Sports Legends interview heard on the Oral History website, voicesofoklahoma.com.
Bill, you were grew up in Canadian, Oklahoma, down in southeast Oklahoma. What sports teams did you follow as a youngster growing up in southeast Oklahoma, and when did you get the feeling that you wanted to be a sports writer?
Well, I'd say the St. Louis Baseball Cardinals were the team that I followed most closely, and followed baseball in general, a lot of the major league teams, and only decided to be a sports writer when I realized I wasn't good enough to hit a curveball, which was pretty early.
Did you cover high school games when you were in high school for the local paper?
Played them. Now, I came from a very small town and very small high school, and there were no newspapers or student papers or anything there. No, I played everything, but I never had an ounce of preparation or experience for the business until I went to college and found myself a little bit overwhelmed.
Now, did you go to Oklahoma A&M at that time?
Right, uh-huh.
And did you major in journalism when you first started?
That's right, not realizing what was required.
Well, did you get to cover some Oklahoma State sports or Oklahoma A&M sports back then for the student paper?
Yes, I did. I was able to do that, I think, my sophomore and junior years, worked on the college paper.
Can you remember the first sporting event you covered for the paper there in college?
No, I don't. I'm sure that, it was probably some intramural minor thing. I doubt that it was a varsity sport, and I don't remember the first varsity sport that I covered either. So it obviously didn't make too much of an impression on me at the time. But I did benefit very much from that opportunity and was very appreciative of it.
Well, now you get an internship with the Tulsa World while you're still in college. How did you manage that?
Well, that was my senior year. I just applied for it, and Mr. B.A. Bridgewater, who was the sports editor at the time, for reasons that I never understood, did hire me over a person that was far more qualified and higher recommended and more experienced and certainly much more deserving of it. And he hired me for that, and very quickly, now keep in mind I was still just a senior there on campus, and very quickly began giving me assignments and sort of put me on full time right there while I was still in college.
Well, tell me about your income at that time. You went from working at the student paper to the Tulsa World. Tell me the jump of income you had then.
Well, I think that my junior year, when I was the sports editor of the Oak Legion, I was paid $7.50 a month, and I started at the Tulsa World at $15 a week and was quickly raised to $25 and then $35 my senior year. So it seemed as though that I had improved myself, at least financially, quite a bit.
Well, when you come to the Tulsa World, what was your beat assignment? Were you assigned regular stories to cover, or what was your assignment back then when you first... Now, what year did you come to the Tulsa World?
Well, I actually didn't come over until the summer of 1953, and we had a pretty small staff then. I believe I was the seventh member of that staff, and we did everything. We worked on the desk, and we covered minor sports and all sports and auto racing and golf and tennis and track, but I guess primarily what I did most was cover college football and college basketball.
Well, now, you're back in those days, of course, Oklahoma was running over almost every opponent they had. What was your first, can you remember your first assignment down at Norman, or can you remember your first?
Yeah, I do. Now, that occurred while I was still at Oklahoma State as a senior, and Mr. Bridgewater had me on regular full-time assignments. And I think the first OU game that I actually covered for the Tulsa World was probably a Kansas State game at Norman. Now, I had seen Oklahoma play as a student and so forth, but for the Tulsa World, I think it would have been Kansas State in 1952.
Do you remember the first time you interviewed Bud Wilkinson?
Yes, I do. It was in the dressing room after a game, and I was quite awed by him because he was such an impressive man, and just, he's kind of fellow who just could walk into a room and everybody looked up to him, whether it was the players or other coaches or whoever, and he had that articulate, charming style, and it was a little bit of an awesome experience for a college senior to be interviewing him, but he tried to make me feel comfortable, and I think eventually did.
He had that way about him, making you feel like you were very important when you were talking with him, didn't he?
He was very attentive and really paid attention to questions, and I'm sure some of them sounded very foolish to him, but he didn't give you the impression they were foolish.
Well, let's jump up a little bit, Bill. When you started at the Tulsa World, kind of tell me, what was the equipment? You had a typewriter and a telephone, and that was about it. Is that right?
Oh, yeah.
Tell me the difference between the Tulsa World 1953 and 1998.
Oh, my gosh. Well, for one thing, I think the staff had seven people in, and I believe they have 24 now. And I was laughing not too long ago. They had more people on vacation a couple of weeks than we had on our staff in 1953. And the primary communication or transmission vehicle at that time was Western Union, and otherwise you went to the games and you wrote your story on a typewriter, and then you gave it to Western Union, and the Tulsa World had a Western Union machine in its office, and so it was transmitted by Western Union, which at that time did not seem primitive, but it was slow, and So a lot has changed, the technology and everything.
Now, when you cover college sports for the Tulsa World, and I remember as a youngster picking up the publications in the late summer in August or so, and they would have the college football report, who was going to win this and who was going to come in certain spot in their conference. And I remember as a kid picking up those publications, and they were all for Tulsa, Oklahoma State, and OU. They were all by Bill Connors, and I thought, wow, how impressive. Here's a man from Tulsa writing for this national publication. Tell us how you got hooked up with all those people, writing all those publications all those years in preseason football selections.
Well, I think that the first publication I ever really wrote for on a regular basis was the Texas football magazine that Dave Campbell published, which is was and is a terrific publication, and a fellow that maybe some people know now as being on ESPN and ABC's college football telecast as an analyst named Beano Cook, who lived in Pittsburgh at that time and was sports information director at Pittsburgh at one time, and I think maybe later worked a little bit for the Steelers, and then was just into all kind of publications. And Beano had an awful lot of friends in the national publication business, and he had seen something that I had written in Dave Campbell's magazine and liked it very much, and then he went to work for ABC as their football publicist, and got to know me a little bit, and he just started recommending me for some positions and seemed like, or assignments, I should say, and just one kind of led to another, and that's how that started.
Well, now, Bill, your career at the Tulsa World, you move up, and when did B.A. Bridgewater was the longtime sports editor of the World. I believe he started, did he start in the 20s?
Yes, he did. I think he was the sports editor, I believe, for 37 years.
Yes. and had a great career at the World. When did Mr. Bridgewater pass away?
He died in 1964.
Okay.
He was in ill health for several years prior to that, but very courageously and with a lot of dignity, continued to work when he could, and was certainly someone that I will forever be indebted to, and was really just an absolute terrific gentleman.
And when were you named the editor of the World?
Well, I was named the executive sports editor in 1959,
mm-hmm.
and Mr. Bridgewater's health was already beginning to decline some at that time, and then I stayed in that capacity until he died in August of 1964. And I was named sports editor after his death.
We've had a wonderful career with the Tulsa World. Let's go over some of the notable sporting events that's happened, and if you can tell me maybe some insight or something you remember about those events. First, let's go. Let's talk about the OU powerhouse days in the 50s. In college football. Were you there when they lost to Notre Dame?
No, I wasn't. I did cover their game with Missouri, which was number 47 in the streak, and I was, I guess everybody can remember where they were when they heard that score, but I was covering Oklahoma State at Kansas that day, and we heard about it up at Lawrence, Kansas, and I remember I was probably like a lot of other people. I had just assumed that OU was unbeatable and was shocked by that score.
What did the crowd do when they announced it?
I don't think that it was announced during uh-huh. the game. I believe that game was a little bit earlier, and I think we heard about it in the press box later.
All right, let's jump to TU. Of course, they were about a 500 ball club in the 50s, and they even had some talk about dropping football in the 50s. But then Glenn Dobbs comes along. Tell me about the innovations that he brought with him to college football. It was a difference between night and day, wasn't it?
Yeah. Well, I think you know, a lot of the younger people now probably just don't know how significant Glenn was, and what a you know, a lot of boldness that he showed. You got to keep in mind, Glenn did not prepare to be a coach, and then just was suddenly thrust into it. And he was quite unconventional about what he wanted to do at that time. And a lot of people didn't think it could be done. And the rules, limited substitution rules, pretty much, you know, kept him harnessed there his first couple of years or so as head coach. But then when the rules changed to two platoon ball, what he had been doing in those years gave him such a head start on everybody else that. And then, of course, he was fortunate in having Jerry Rome and Howard Twilley here that Tulsa was just, you know, miles ahead of everyone with what it was able to do with the passing game in 1964. And most defenses just, you know, were not prepared to know how to cope with that. And so that was quite significant and certainly saved TU football and
helped build Skelly Stadium, didn't it?
Right, yeah.
Henry Iba, the legendary basketball coach at Oklahoma A&M, Oklahoma State, tell me about that. I think the one year that stands out with me, the last year he won the Big 8 title. Can you remember those days?
Oh, yeah. I consider the greatest fringe benefit I ever had out of this business was getting a chance to cover and know Mr. Iba, and he certainly is one of the just rare giants of a man that I ever knew. You know, he not only was a great coach, a lot of people have forgotten what a great athletic director he was and what all he did for that school back.
He also was the baseball coach for
right.
a time.
Yeah, and discovered Allie Reynolds when yes. Allie Reynolds was a
that's right.
football player and got Allie Reynolds converted into being a full-time pitcher. But he was such a great man, you know, the most principled and modest of the famous men I ever knew. And, you know, very compassionate, just fiercely loyal man. And he really... You know, was someone that I think everyone who ever knew him looked up to, and we tend to now think of him as just a great coach, but there was a lot of greatness about him in all respects.
Why did in 1957, when Oklahoma A&M, when they switched over to the Big Eight, can you tell me a little background on that? Why did they do that?
Well, first of all, pardon me.
We'll edit that out. Don't worry.
When the old Missouri Valley, which included a lot of the state schools that went to the Big Seven and then the Big Six, then the Big Seven, then the Big Eight, left, the Oklahoma A&M was the one that was kind of left dangling there. And as time went on, Oklahoma A&M and then Oklahoma State, as it became known, just felt like it needed to be aligned more with the other state universities as opposed to the private schools. And the Valley had a lot of instability about it at that time. And the bottom line, of course, was the financial stability of the football programs in the Big Seven as opposed to the Missouri Valley Conference. And, you know, as costs were escalating and everything, it was just imperative that a football program generate a lot more revenue than Oklahoma State could generate with its football program operating in the Missouri Valley Conference. And so Mr. Iba lobbied long and hard for that move, and I think it was widely agreed in the conference that the main reason that they admitted Oklahoma State was Mr. Iba. Now, it didn't happen until OU supported the move, and I think OU felt politically pressured to do that. And once OU supported it, it was just an automatic thing. But he was certainly the big factor, I think, in that finally being approved.
Let's talk about some of your interviews that you've conducted. Of course, you've talked with many, many famous people. Let's just start with some people from around Oklahoma. Tell me about your feelings about interviewing and talking with many times Johnny Bench, the Hall of Fame catcher with the Cincinnati Reds, and of course from Binger, Oklahoma.
Well, I knew Johnny when he was first coming up out of the minor leagues, and interviewed him down in Florida. Actually, I think before he had made the Reds roster that first time. And I remember at the time my first impression of him, without even knowing how good he was that here's this 19 or 20-year-old fella who's never been to college and raised in a small town, and he seemed to have the maturity of a 30-year-old man, college graduate. And he just was mature beyond his years and totally confident, not in an overbearing way, but totally fearless of any challenges or competition, and he just went on to be even better than a lot of people predicted, and people were predicting he would be great at the time.
Of course, okay.
I was just going to say, and I've enjoyed knowing Johnny through the years, and really consider him a friend, and proud to do so.
Tell me about Allie Reynolds. Of course, he had retired from the Yankees when you began to cover big assignments for the Tulsa World, but you talked to him many times when he's here for the Diamond Dinner, and he helped reestablish the American Association. Tell me your feelings about Allie and what he did for baseball here in Oklahoma after he did retire.
Well, I always thought that Allie was one of the great gentlemen, and he had to be one of the greatest ambassadors baseball ever had. I've never heard of anyone requesting Allie to do something for baseball that he didn't do. That was within reason. And, go to a function, whether it was a big or a small-time event, and just always conducted himself with such humility and was just, just a great, great person. And I never had the opportunity to actually see him pitch, but I've heard from a lot of people, including Mantle and others, and he was really a terrific pitcher and a very competitive fella, and was obviously handicapped in some ways by how good and versatile he was. because Casey Stengel would use him both as a starter and reliever, and often would bypass his starting assignment against a weak opponent if they had a crucial series coming up where, say, he could start Allie in the season opener and the series opener and still have him available to relieve maybe, you know, in the third or fourth game. And I think, you know, Stengel said that in all of his time in baseball, he had never known anyone who was as good as both a starter and reliever at the same time.
Talk about Heisman Trophy winner for Miami, Steve Owens, and how he really helped bring the OU football program back. And, of course, he had some lean years when he first started. But tell us about that his senior campaign when he won the Heisman Trophy as a running back at OU.
Well, you know, Steve just had amazing durability. His conditioning and toughness and determination were his trademarks. And he could just go out and carry the ball 45 or 55 times a game and still be strong on the last carry of the game. And, one of the things I most remember about Steve, and it doesn't seem that significant, but the last game of the season against Oklahoma State, after he had won the Heisman Trophy, I think that preceding Tuesday or Wednesday, he carried the ball against Oklahoma State, 53 times or something, and gained about 260 yards. And at the end of the game, OU was unable to run out the clock and keep possession, and they were only ahead by 1 point. And Steve, you know, you got to think he's awful tired, and they have him on the special teams, and Oklahoma State had the Big 8 Conference's leading punt returner, Dickie Graham, and he was really a dangerous punt returner. And if Graham could have returned the punt, you know, just within field position, Oklahoma State's got time to kick the field goal there with about a minute left. And Steve sprints down the field and tackles Graham for either, no gain or a short gain on the punt return, and keeps Oklahoma State in bad field position where they can't get in position to win the game. And I just always thought that was kind of, typical of the effort that he always made and how amazingly strong he remained throughout the game.
Tell me about your relationship with Jimmy Johnson. What was he was a man driven to succeed even when he got the job here at Oklahoma State. Tell me about some of the times you've interviewed Jimmy Johnson and what you thought about his coaching style.
Well, I think everybody always knew from the time Jimmy was a player at Arkansas that he was very bright and he had a lot of leadership about him and would be a good coach. And the older coaches over there at Arkansas tried to help get him into coaching. And otherwise, it certainly was no surprise that he did well. I think he changed after he went to Miami. At Oklahoma State, Jimmy was really a sort of a players-type coach who just constantly went around cheerfully boosting the players' morale and patting them on the back and encouraging them. And I don't mean that he was a loose disciplinarian, but Jimmy was really considered a players' coach, and he still was, I think, when he went to Miami. And his third year in Miami in 1986, when they had that fabulous team. I've forgotten how many guys off that team went to the pros, something like 14 or 16, I think. And just, Benny Testaverde, that was his Heisman Trophy year. And just all those great players. And they lost the national championship to Penn State in the Fiesta Bowl. And I think there was a general feeling that Penn State was a little bit more mentally tough and prepared and disciplined and everything. And I think that experience really changed Jimmy, because the next time I saw him, and I was seeing him a lot during that time, OU was playing them, Tulsa played them, and he talked to him and everything. And in 87, after that experience in 86, I think you saw a tougher, more detached, determined Jimmy Johnson, more, total business-like guy emerge. And the team that won the national championship for him in 87 wasn't nearly as talented as the one that came up short in 86, but, you know, probably was a little tougher, more sound, you know, tougher mentally, not tougher physically.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, by the time he went to Dallas, that was the approach he had. In other words, I think he was ready to be a pro coach who could pop the whip on those pros. And I think he changed his style after he became a head coach.
One thing I've always enjoyed reading your columns, Bill, is the build-up and the stories you would always write about the Oklahoma-Texas football game. The stories you'd write about Bud Wilkinson and Chuck Fairbanks and Barry Switzer and Darryl Royal and all that. Was that a game that you looked forward to covering each year? Was that something where, as a player or as a writer, you would get excited about just like a player? Tell me some of the crazy things that happened with you covering the OU-Texas game.
Well, I guess if you really start back, you can think of a lot, but a couple that come to mind to me in, I think it was 1962, Bud did not take Lance Rensel on the traveling squad to Dallas. I don't remember how far down on the depth chart he was, but... Anyway, he just joined a lot of OU students and went to Dallas and I think had a pretty good time Friday night and probably wasn't in the best of condition to play a game, but went out to the stadium and joined the team that day and wound up, making a touchdown or something and a critical kind of... Now, OU still lost the game that day, but... He was primarily responsible for the big play that put OU in a position where it might win the game. And I remember, you know, Bud later kind of grinned and shook his head and everything about thinking, you know, all the things you try to do that are right and everything. And then, you know, you might win or lose the game on something like that. And then the other thing that I think of was in 1971 when Oklahoma finally beat Darryl. And it was the second year of Oklahoma's wishbone.
Right, the first time the two wishbone powers met.
Well, now they had actually met in 70 when it was OU's first game.
Right, now they unveiled the wishbone against them, right?
But now a year later in 71, and they're both terrific, and it's really a big game, and Oklahoma won decisively. Just a great game. Jack Mildren absolutely just played, you know, one of the all-time great games. And Barry Switzer was the offensive coordinator, and he's up in the press box, and when the game's about to end, he wants to go down on the field to be down there to, enjoy the celebration because it had been a long time since they'd won the game. Well, now, former President Johnson, Lyndon Johnson, as you know, was a big University of Texas fan, a very close friend of Darryl Royal, and he was at the game, but he went by the OU dressing room to congratulate Oklahoma. And Barry Switzer is running by there, and someone of President Johnson's aides tried to stop him or tell him. He said, President Johnson wants to meet you. And Barry said, just a minute. He said, I want to shake Jack Mildren's hand first. And typical Barry Switzer, you know, he was more concerned with this quarterback who had helped them win the game. He thought that Jack Mildren was a bigger hero that day than the former president of the United States. But, you know, some of those kind of things I remember.
Bill, tell me about the little skinny kid that the University of Tulsa received in 63 that was a wide receiver from Houston, or a suburb of Houston, Howard Twelly. Tell me how you saw him blossom into becoming probably the all-time greatest wide receiver in college football history.
Well, obviously, I was probably like a lot of other people, had no idea when they recruited him that he had a chance to even be a player at all, and I think that was the general feeling of the staff. They hadn't seen him, and they'd recruited him on a recommendation, and I think Howard fibbed a little bit on his application of how tall he was, and they were a little, disappointed when he showed up as a freshman. But what I first remember about him was that Tulsa had another wide receiver, a tall guy named Simmons, who was really pretty good. And in Howard's sophomore year, which was Simmons' senior year, Sometime there around the 1st of November, I think Simmons was injured. And that's when Howard first got a chance to play. And my goodness, you know, he was just instantly good. I mean, there wasn't any question. And I, you know, say this with no disrespect to Simmons, but I think, you know, after a couple of games, people thought, well, gosh, this kid's better than Simmons. He doesn't look like he ought to be as good. He's a lot smaller, and he's probably not as fast. But, you know, he's got those great hands and determination. And then he just went on from there. And obviously, you know, as a junior, Rome, and he formed one of the great passing batteries of all time. And the next year after Rome was gone and Billy Anderson was the quarterback, it just continued. And Howard was the runner-up for the Heisman Trophy and set all those records. He just, you know, a fabulous player.
Tell me about Barry Switzer. You've interviewed him dozens of times, from an assistant all the way up through his head coaching days with the Dallas Cowboys. What type of coach was he? What type of I think I know what you're going to answer, but tell me a little insight on what made Barry Switzer, and how he seemed to get every ounce of ability of every player that suited up for him up until last year with the Dallas Cowboys.
Yeah, well, you know, first of all, Barry was a very bright young guy coming out of high school and going to college, and had a lot of leadership abilities that Frank Broyles and the other coaches over there recognized. And when he got into coaching, he was really obsessed with learning the X's and O's of the game. And contrary to what a lot of people think, throughout Barry's assistant apprenticeship, that's what he was noted for. And primarily, when Oklahoma went to the wishbone in 1950, it was Barry's responsibility as offensive coordinator to learn the offense and then teach it to the assistant coaches and teach it to the players. And he got a great reputation in the coaching profession for being such an outstanding technician. And there were a lot of people, you know, going to Norman for coaching clinics and trying to learn the wishbone from Barry and everything. Now, he did recruit Jack Mildren, and he made a project of that and practically lived in Abilene, Texas. And as, you know, I imagine a lot of your listeners know, Mildren was considered the top high school prospect in the country, and Sports Illustrated did a story on him and all this. And so I'm not going to say that Barry was a poor recruiter. He certainly never was. But he was far better noted for his being a technician. Then after he became a head coach, and he started stressing the importance of recruiting, and I always felt like he did himself, you know, a disservice by his public comments about it's all the players and it's all recruiting. And I never forget his first game as head, his first Texas game as head coach, and they beat Texas. What was it, 50-something to?
Yeah,
14
the worst whipping they ever received. Yeah.
Yeah, and in the dressing room, in the coach's dressing room there in the Cotton Bowl after it was over, I'm in there, and he walked around the dressing room there and shook every assistant coach's hand, and he said, men, don't ever forget the reason this happened. He said, it wasn't the people in this room, it was the people in the other room, pointing toward the players. He said, don't ever stop recruiting. And you know, it just seemed like gradually through the years, his critics and everybody said, well, yeah, he's a good recruiter, but he doesn't know how to coach. And I mean, that's just ludicrous. I mean, the guy was mm-hmm. a terrific coach.
Let's go back to baseball for a few minutes. And, of course, Oklahoma's produced tons of good ball players and played here with the Tulsa Oilers. But tell me about A. Ray Smith, the longtime owner of the Tulsa Oilers from 61 to 76. Tell me, you've interviewed him a lot. Tell me about the struggles he had of just keeping the ballpark open, even though they had terrific teams.
Yeah, I think, you know, a lot of people probably don't realize how close Tulsa might have been to losing the franchise when he came to Grail Hallett's rescue and then eventually took over the franchise totally and spent a lot of his own money to improve things such as parking lots and concessions and everything, and just, couldn't get the political or civic leadership of Tulsa interested enough in building a new park or sufficiently improving the old one, and, kept saying that he was afraid, something bad would happen to the old park. But before he left, he certainly generated a lot of new interest in the Oilers, and hired the right people and did a lot of the right kind of promotion and marketing to set attendance records for that time, and had some terrific teams and some very colorful managers like Charlie Metro and Warren Spahn, and some terrific teams. I always remember back in 1966, I think that there were some people that at one time thought that the Cardinals had a better outfield in Tulsa than they did in St. Louis. When they had Bobby Tolan and Savage and
Alex Johnson
and mm-hmm. Walt Williams all down here, kind of rotating around, and mm-hmm. that was a better outfield than the one they had in St. Louis. But A. Ray really, did his best to keep the team here, and certainly did a lot for Tulsa. And I always appreciated, the other people that he brought in to become involved with the club, like Pepper Martin and Satchel Paige. And
those diamond dinners were something, weren't they?
Oh, yeah. They had to be the best baseball dinners in any minor league city, and he very carefully scheduled them around the St. Louis dinner, where he could get people to come in here maybe on their way to St. Louis. And
An average diamond dinner was like Joe DiMaggio and Willie Mays and Pepper Martin and Ralph Terry and Mantle. That was an average dinner,
yeah,
wasn't it?
Yeah, I have Spahn and Musial those were really a lot of fun.
Let's talk about Mickey Mantle. Of course, Mickey had gone to the major leagues in 1951, and you go to work for the Tulsa World in 1953. And, of course, Mantle lived in the Commerce and Spavinaw area till 1960
mm-hmm.
and would come to Tulsa quite often to play golf and have business meetings and so what. Tell me what you thought of Mickey when he was really 21, 22 years old, and how he matured. And he never really did lose that friendly Oklahoma way of doing of meeting people and greeting people, even during his tough years when the alcohol was had taken control. Did he?
I did not know Mickey, say at 21 or 22. I think the first time I ever actually met him was at the Diamond Dinner, probably in 56 or 57, and I didn't really get a chance to know him till a little bit later. But I tell you one thing, and this is obviously very personal to me, but I show you, I think that how Mantle was, like you described him, that for the first Sunday column I wrote as sports editor, I wanted to do an interview with Mantle. Now, keep in mind, that was in September of 1964, and he was injured. The Yankees were in a big pennant race with the Orioles, and they had a series with the Orioles that week. And anyway, I'd gotten in touch with one of his brothers who called Mickey, and he'd call me back and give me his number of where to call him. And on a day where he had been to the doctor and was really having all kind of problems with his knee, and then that night they're going to play the Orioles and everything, and gave me an interview, and, was terrific about it. And obviously, that day kind of wormed his way into my heart enough that I always had a special affection for him, but got to know him probably a lot better after that. And, there's no telling how good he could have been had he had the strong legs when he came to the big leagues. People talk so much about how the alcohol and the high living probably shortened his career, and I'm not to say that it didn't, but when he had osteomyelitis at age 14, that was
Well, they were going to amputate his leg.
Yeah, I mean, I had a friend in my little town, hometown, that had that. And you know, he never got out of a wheelchair. And for Mickey to come out of that and be able to have the kind of career he did on those legs, and I just think it was remarkable that he did as well as he did. And I really I miss him.
Let's talk about one of the boldest moves that the University of Tulsa ever did in their athletic department. They had gone through some lean years in basketball, and it didn't look too good for Tulsa basketball at that time. And then the interim athletic director at TU, Dr. Emory Turner, hired this junior college coach from West Texas, Nolan Richardson. Tell me the background of how they went ahead and hired Nolan, and tell us, TU went out on a limb, honestly, for hiring a black coach, didn't they?
The coach that they really courted and tried to hire the hardest,
that's right,
was Billy Tubb.
That's right.
And even the day that they actually hired Nolan and went down to pick him up in the airplane, they made one more pass at Beaumont trying to hire Billy Tubbs. But I think that the late Pascal Twyman deserves a lot of credit for that, too, because I remember after Nolan had entered the picture and we at the newspaper first found out about it, wondering, because, at that time it hadn't been, 20 years before when Nolan had come here to play for UTEP, he couldn't even, stay with his teammates.
Yeah, it was less than 20 years. Yeah. I believe it was 62 or 63,
yeah,
something like that.
And wondering, if Tulsa would really hire a black coach. And I remember one of the trustees at the University of Tulsa, who was a friend of mine, and I asked, would that really happen? And I remember him telling me, he said, that the board had enough respect for Pascal Twyman, that if he recommended it, he said it will be approved, and there was no question. And that when Emory, took Nolan over to meet Twyman, that he was all for it. So, yeah, but you're right; it was a bold move, and it certainly was the right move.
Well, that was something with that group of really, he brought his junior college national championship team in. And that transformed Tulsa, really, after the Louisville game. They played two or three games, and when they played Louisville, you remember that game? And
yeah, I remember it very well.
How crazy the crowd was?
Yeah, I know that I remember talking to Denny Crum the morning of that game, and, Louisville was the defending national champion.
That's right.
And Denny was talking about how unusual it was for Tulsa to, just really in effect take last year's national championship junior college team, and now they're trying to defeat last year's NCAA Division I championship team, and he knew that they were pretty good, but I don't think he or anyone at TU or anyone expected TU to win that game. And once that game was over, basketball was never the same at TU again. Hasn't been since.
We've had many great golf tournaments here in Tulsa at Southern Hills and PGA tournaments and so forth, but I think the interview that you did in 1977 with Jack Nicklaus will always stand out for me. Tell me a little bit about getting to sit down and visit with the Golden Bear here in Tulsa.
Yeah, that is. That's certainly a special event in my memory. Person affiliated with the tournament had called me that day and just alerted me that Nicklaus, this would have been, say, 10 days before the tournament started, and said that he was flying in that day, and they didn't really want it known, and it wasn't for publicity purposes or anything. He just was going to, play the course and hope that no one would be around, but this person said, don't tell anybody I told you, but what time he'd be there. So I went out, and I had met him once before and had been around him a little, but not interviewed him. And I just introduced myself and said I'd like to talk to him. And he was very cordial, and he said, "Won't you just follow us around?" And I followed him the entire 18 holes And, you know, he was all business on that. He occasionally talked a little, but not much. And then when it was over, we went in there at the grill at Southern Hills, and he ordered some iced tea, and we sat there. And I know that his pilot and his caddy were antsy to, you know, get back in the plane and get out of there because they hadn't planned to stay that long. And he just sat there and talked and talked and was absolutely, you know, a great gentleman and very candid and really impressed me as just a terrific gentleman. And I've had the good fortune of, you know, having other interviews and some dealings with him where he's been, you know, very helpful and complimentary and friendly, and I really appreciate knowing him.
Well, one more question here about your famous interviews, Bill. Tell me about your all-time favorite interview back in Kansas City in 1958 with Ted Williams. Tell me that story.
Yeah, that does stand out to me as my favorite interview. You had to keep in mind, as a kid, he was my hero, and I'd been under the delusion that maybe someday I could hit like him, and I'd always followed him and everything. And this was in July of 1958, and I was on vacation. Just had about a week left in my vacation, and the Red Sox were opening a series in Kansas City, and I had often, even while I was at the Tulsa World, on days off or vacation, I had gone to Kansas City just to watch the Red Sox play just because of him, and had done that when the old Browns were in St. Louis, too, and had never gone as in a press capacity, just gone on my own. And so at this time, I thought, I'd just like to go up there and interview him. So I called the Red Sox publicity man at the hotel where they were staying, and to my surprise, he said it'd be no problem if I would come up there. And he said that Williams liked to go to the ballpark at least an hour or so before the rest of the team, and that he would go in a cab, and he would be out there like 3 hours ahead of the game, and said that if I could get a pass and get to the ballpark and get out there, that he's sure he would interview me and would grant the interview. And you know, I was a little bit apprehensive. I because Williams had a reputation of not liking to be interviewed and was pretty unfriendly with a lot of the press. And so I went to Kansas City just hoping that this thing wouldn't fall apart on me, and went out to the park and got my pass and was there. And that was in the old Kansas City ballpark. The visiting the clubhouse was up on a hill sort of behind the third base side, and I had to go in the park on the playing field level and go down the third base side and go up the entrance just like the players would. And I'm walking up there, and when I can see him seated in front of the clubhouse. He's in uniform, and he's got about three or four bats in his hand, just swinging them back and forth, and he's looking at me, and with those penetrating eyes following me all the way up there. And I'm thinking, oh my gosh, he's going to tell me to get lost, and I just know he's not going to agree to this interview. And I walk up there, and just as I get there, he sticks out his hand, he said, I'm Ted Williams. And I said, yeah, I know who you are. I said, I hope you know who I am. And he said, you're the writer from Tulsa, huh? And I said, yeah. And he was absolutely sensational. I mean, we sat there, just he and I, for about an hour, and he talks, awful fast and awful loud, and he answered every question and talked about things, I just kind of sat there spellbound. And one of the things that I remembered, always that he told me when I had asked him if he thought that anyone could ever break Ruth's record, he said, there's a guy on this club talking about Kansas City. And he said, if he ever could get traded to Detroit or the Yankees, he said, I think he might do it because he's got such a great swing. And he's talking about Maris. Hmm. And I said, Cleveland kind of gave up on this guy even when he was in the minor leagues at Tulsa. And he said, well, he's got a great swing, and he said he might do it. Well, years later, after Williams became manager of the Senators, I interviewed him down in Florida, and I reminded him of that, and he told me that was to his knowledge, the only time he'd ever said that to anybody or be printed. And he asked me if I would go back and find that and mail it to him, and I did. And I interviewed him, you know, two or three times later, and he was always interesting, and talked to him up at the Hall of Fame a few years ago. But, you know, I don't think anything could ever quite equal that, just a one-on-one with him for, you know, at least an hour.
Well, now, what are your responsibilities at the World was hiring writers? And I know you, did you hire John Ferguson, or did he come with the building?
John, I'll tell you, I actually went to work for the paper a little bit earlier than John, but John was in Tulsa working, I think, on New Year's Day or New Year's Eve, say, the 52-53 year, and I didn't actually come to the staff in Tulsa until June of 53.
Mm-hmm.
So he was in the building before me.
Boy, he is a wonderful man and a terrific writer, and you should be commended for allowing him to continue on and
it was my pleasure to work with him. And he's the best ambassador the Tulsa World ever had in sports or anything, and absolutely a terrific person.
Tell me about
a good worker, obviously.
That's right. Tell me about Mike Brown, the longtime high school editor. He does a wonderful job, too.
Yeah, I think we hired Mike in about 1979, I believe. I don't have my chart in front of me here, but I think it was about that time. And he's absolutely a Trojan. That guy loves his job and works at it so hard, and the hours he keeps and always has, you know, he's remarkable.
Here's a couple of old-time favorites of mine, Dean Clark.
Yeah, I think Dean had, you know, been an outstanding student at the University of Oklahoma and had been in the Army and was getting out of the Army, and our managing editor at the time had spoken at some journalism function down at OU, and maybe the director of the School of Journalism or something had told him about Dean, and then he told me about Dean, and we hired him probably in about 69, I believe. Dean had been to Vietnam and was out of the service at that time.
Terrell Lester, of course, he was in sports and then moved on to other sections of the paper, but Terrell was a very good sports writer.
Terrell was the first person I hired after I became sports editor. That summer, he worked for us doing some kid baseball stuff, and we had other young people doing things like that on a part-time basis in the summer. But he was a little bit older and so much better and more talented and obviously more dedicated and wanted to work so bad and everything that there was no question but what we wanted to put him on the staff full-time and did. And he was, you know, not only just a good writer, he's a terrific desk layout person, one of the best, you know, the paper's ever had.
And then the current editor of The World, John Klein.
Yeah, I think John was working at Ardmore, and we probably hired him in about 1978, I believe. I think it was in 78. And then I think he left in 85 to go to the Houston Post, and then came back to the paper in a news site capacity, I don't know what year, but, you know, a few years after that.
Mm-hmm. Well, Bill, we appreciate this interview, and congratulations on your induction into the Oklahoma Sports Hall of Fame coming up August the 10th, and congratulations to you, and it's an honor well-deserved, and we hope there's many more years of reading those great Bill Connors columns in the Tulsa World.
Okay, Wayne, thank you. It's my pleasure.